Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Red and Buried podcast. I'm Frankie, and what a treat to be joined by the wonderful Emily Freud.
Thank you so much for having me on, Frankie. It's brilliant to be here.
Oh, it's a true pleasure to have you on. I've been for about a year saying to you, will you come on my podcast, talk about the new book. And finally, here you are.
So, and I'm wearing red lipstick as well. It may have faded a little bit during bedtime, but it's still hanging on for dear life, just for you.
Oh, you spoil me with it. I remember actually at Harrogate last year, you were like, I found a red lipstick that I like.
I know. That was actually, I was at an agent's dinner, and Julie Cohen was there, and she always wears red lipstick. And she was like, Emily, you need to wear some. And she got some lipstick out of her bag and like bought me how to put it on. So I've suddenly become a bit of a red lipstick wearer.
Yes, join the club. It looks great on you. Lovely shade. Before we get into, obviously, this lipstick chat is also very nice, but that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about you. Well, we can, but I'd much rather talk about your amazing new book. But before we get into the chat, I've got a little bio about you that I'm going to read out, because you've got a very interesting career path that we'll get into as well. So hit him. Emily Freud is the author of 3 crime fiction novels, soon to be 4, because I know you're working on the 4th one at the moment. She also makes TV, including award-winning programmes such as Educating Yorkshire, First Dates and SAS Who Dares Wins, as well as developing original programming for all main broadcasters. Is that still true? Are you still working TV?
I'm freelance, so I can sort of dabble a bit here or there when I need to.
Nice. Okay, so it's kind of still true.
Cool. Yeah.
Her debut novel, My Best Friend's Secret, was published in 2021, followed by What She Left Behind in 2022. Her latest novel, Her Last Summer, is out in April and has been described as a must for all true crime documentary lovers. 20 years ago, Mari vanished while backpacking through Thailand with her boyfriend, Luke. He was accused of murder, but has always insisted he's innocent. Besides, her body was never found. Now, he's finally ready to talk. And Cassidy Chambers wants to be the one to uncover what really happened back then in the dark of the jungle. But as she delves deeper into the past, Cassidy begins to fear what lies ahead and the secrets buried along the way. Oh, da, 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 so exciting. Outside of writing, Emily lives in London with her husband and 2 young children. As well as being a very talented and all-round creative storyteller and writer, she's also very warm, kind, and a pleasure to spend time with.
Oh, that was lovely.
It's all true. It's all true. The speaking Welling facts. Well, so you, I have to say, have had a pretty fast run through publishing, it seems like.
I know. Well, My Best Friend's Secret, which is here, was my debut.
Yes.
I think I wrote this. It came out in 2020. I think I wrote it in 2018, actually. And then I've been trying to do a book a year, but it's taking me longer and longer to find the hook and the idea of what I want to write about. And I don't know if that's because I've sort of used up all my life experience a bit, or I've realized that all my books I've got an expertise in. So My Best Friend's Secret is about a recovering alcoholic. I've got the Blue Peter badge in that. And What She Left Behind, I would say, is my pandemic book. It's really claustrophobic. Mm. It's about child rearing in isolation, really. And that was my experience in the pandemic. It's not about pandemic or anything like that. It's about coercive control. And then Her Last Summer is about a filmmaker, which is my career. So I feel like I'm slowly ticking off everything I know loads about. I'm going to have to...
The next book will be about a girl that wears red lipstick and recently discovered.
I'm going to have to retrain in something to learn.
So do you think it's true that you need to write what you know?
I think because I write quite emotional, all my characters go on really big emotional journeys, and I really like to get into the under the skin of them. And I write in first person. And I don't know, I just feel like once I know the ins and outs of the emotional roller coaster, my storytelling is much better. Mm. And actually, my fourth book is about an author. So
there we go. Yes,
there you go, which I'm really excited about.
I'm excited. Let's do this one first, and then we'll have to.
Sorry, I just talk rambled on then for ages.
Not at all. This is what I would like you to do. This is really helpful for me because it gives us stuff to talk about. So please, that's what you're here for. So let's talk about the new book, not the next new book.
Yes,
the new book. Her Last Summer, set in Thailand. Beautiful Thailand. I'm just so curious about your experience with Thailand. Did you have to go there for research, or had you been there before? What does it mean to you as a place?
So I went backpacking there in 2002, the same year that Luke and Mari went there. And I really wanted to write about that first real taste of freedom, really far away from home. Like the adrenaline rush, the excitement, but also it was really scary as well. And I wanted to write about that time in 2002 because it's quite a formative time in my life. But also, you know, The Beach had just come out with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yes.
The film based on Alex Garland's book, The Beach. And it just felt like it was a real moment. It was an era, a real moment in that era. And I really wanted to write about it.
And it feels steeped in that as well. And that very, very atmospheric, heavy feeling around it. But you've captured the excitement of the youth of it brilliantly as well. So that is where you drew your inspiration from. Have you been back since for any kind of follow-up visits?
I haven't thought to write this book. What I found really handy, because I couldn't go to Thailand because I've got two little kids and it was just a bit much for them, was now travellers just upload their journeys on YouTube.
Yes.
Like even train journeys, they film them like going to the station, getting on the train, what the toilets look like, all of this stuff.
Covered for you.
It's like amazing. I really wanted to write about the Koh San Road, which is sort of the main backpackers road in Bangkok. And if you're a backpacker, a young backpacker, you'll end up on that road. It's where you kind of have reunions with your friends. It'll be where you get visas sorted, where you organise travel. It's a real hub. And I looked it up on YouTube, and that road had a really big makeover since 2002 and looks quite different. It's much more sanitised. And I wouldn't have known that if it hadn't been for being able to research online, actually. So it's an amazing resource to have.
Yeah, I remember when I spoke to Kate Gray, she was saying that she watched loads of honeymoon videos for her book, because people just post their entire honeymoons on YouTube.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy when you think about it. But yeah, very helpful, though.
It's really helpful because I had two timelines. I had Luke telling, because Luke's being interviewed by the filmmaker, they do a master interviews, and that's how you get the backstory. So he's telling his story from 2002, and then they actually go back there in present day 20 years later. So it was really important to get it right.
And how did you find writing in those different voices for Luke and for Cassidy's voice as well?
I found the Luke stuff actually quite easy. I really enjoyed writing about Thailand in 2002. I have really strong memories of being there, and they go to all the the only place I didn't go to in Thailand was the jungle.
Oh, really?
Everywhere else I went to the party islands. I mean, mainly because me and my friend Emma, we were quite useless. We like ended up on an island. We're having such a good time. and we'd be like, no, we've got to go to the next place. We've got to go to the next place. But we'd be so hungover. And then we're all so early in the morning, these ferries. And every morning we'd miss them. So we're stuck on this island for weeks, I think. But in 2016, I made a TV series in the Amazon jungle. And the experience of being in that claustrophobic environment and the thought of being lost out there, where, you know, if you walk a few meters and turn around, you don't know the right way to go. If you get lost, it's actually terrifying. And my sister went to Thailand after me, and she went to Chiang Mai on a trek, like Luke and Mari do. And her and her boyfriend went to find somewhere to have a pee, and they got a bit lost for
oh my god,
only for half an hour, but
that's enough.
it's enough. She could have been Luke and Mary.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Cautionary tale. Be careful where you pee.
Be really careful where you pee, guys, in the jungle.
Yeah. So true.
Next time you're there.
Yeah, that's it. Next time you're in, it's important, I think, for any location, really, just be careful where you pee, but especially in the jungle, absolutely. And you are a filmmaker by kind of trade, and there's filmmaking within it. How was that experience of writing about your industry? Do you think that it gave you a special insight for the character? And yeah, how did you bring that to life?
I'd always, in the back of my mind, thought telling a story about someone trying to tell a story would be really interesting. And I couldn't quite work out how to do it. And then I got this idea about Luke and Mari. And I really enjoyed it, actually. And I thought it just lent so perfectly, that mechanic of a beginning, middle and end. Because when you're making a TV series, there's pre-production, there's production, and there's post-production. So there's a real natural beginning, middle and end anyway. And the idea that Cassidy is finding out the story as the reader does, I was really excited by that prospect. But also just being able to drop in details about filming, about, you know, shooting schedules and why. And there's so much jeopardy when you're filming. There is, you're just constantly firefighting. So, for example, filming in the jungle was a nightmare because of the humidity and all of that stuff, and, you know, microphones getting wet and all kinds of stuff. So what you want in a psychological thriller is a situation where lots of stuff could go wrong. So there's actually nowhere better, really, than trying to film something, because there's a raft of things that can go wrong.
And do you think as well, your background in TV and kind of coming up with story ideas and things has given you an appreciation for like action beats within a thriller?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when, you know, I think that when I was editing, I did a bit of edit producing as well. So it is exactly the same as trying to make a drama film. There needs to be a story arc, and you need to kind of hit the right notes. But I think also watching a lot of true crime documentaries, I was really heavily influenced by stuff like The Jinx and Making a Murderer and The Staircase, for example. Especially because in those documentaries, the relationship between the filmmaker and the contributor was so fascinating.
I mean, yes,
I think in the Jinx, is it Andrew Geriaki? He originally made a film about Robert Durst, starring Ryan Gosling, and Robert Durst was so incensed that he picked up the phone and called Andrew Geriaki. I think I'm saying his name right, and said, I want to tell my story to you, okay? And you could tell the director was, you know, really conflicted, because this guy had given him this great story, and he did like him, I think, quite a lot, even though he knew he'd done these awful things. So I just felt that the relationship between filmmaker and contributor was fascinating. And what if I ramped up that jeopardy, and the filmmaker and the contributor actually fell in love? Wouldn't that be interesting?
Very interesting. And the blurring of lines and the kind of the ethical boundaries of making something like that. It's a whole host of excitement and drama.
Yeah, like the moral conflict is, I mean, I think in The Staircase, the French editor of the film ended up having a relationship with the guy, I can't remember his name. Peterson, and it just the whole thought. Well, did she edit the film in his favour? Then, you know, it's really interesting thing to analyse.
I thought you were going to say the editor had a relationship with the owl, allegedly pushed her down the stairs.
That would be interesting
plot twist.
I don't even know how that would work. But
I don't want to think about it too much. But and it also kind of reminded me of a bit like Serial as well, from like a true crime podcast perspective, that very interpersonal relationship between a documentary maker and the subject, where it kind of goes beyond just reporting what you're seeing. It's that relationship, as you say.
Yeah. And, you know, when you're working with contributors, you do get to know them really well, and they're trusting you with to tell their story. And, you know, you're trusting them that they're telling you the truth. It's a real relationship based on trust. And Yeah, it's really fascinating thing to unpick in a book. I've really enjoyed it. I've loved writing it.
I loved reading it. So it's really, you captured it beautifully. That, as you said, that kind of moral ambiguity around it as well. And the way that, yeah, I don't want to spoil too much for people because people need to go and read it. Obviously, it's really difficult. But yeah, no, you capture it really, really nicely.
Good.
And I'm really curious. One of the questions I like to ask everyone I speak to is, if you had to be a character from one of your books, this book perhaps, who would you be and why?
Well, I would definitely be Cassidy in this book.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want to be, I don't want to go into it too much.
No, I know.
Think, I'm going to stick with Cassidy. I just think she's a really strong woman and she's been through stuff and she's a fighter. And I'm sort of, I'm a bit of a warrior and maybe I don't do things because I'm too nervous. And she wouldn't think like that. She would just go out there and do whatever she could. So, definitely Cassidy.
Do you think that if you're writing a character, you do put a bit of yourself in them, even though it may not be outwardly like that? You say you think there are obvious differences between you and Cassidy, but I think there's a lot of you in her still, like her warmth and her...
Aww. I definitely think there's part of me and all my protagonists.
Mm.
It's almost like you take a part of yourself and you blow it up to the extreme. You sort of grow it in a petri dish or something and play with it. And it's really fun being able to do that. It's, you know, it's like transporting yourself into someone else and having the chance to have a huge adventure, right? It's like the next stage of reading a book is actually sitting there and being the kind of puppeteer in that character's world and working out who they are, what they're going to do, what they would say in a certain situation. And that's really fun.
Yeah, I guess play God a little bit.
Yeah.
With your character.
I never thought about it like that, but yeah.
Yeah, kind of. And let's talk a bit about the writing process, because you said you're kind of doing or working towards a book a year.
Mm.
And how are you finding it on now you're on book four? Has your process changed a lot over the years, or have you settled into quite a good rhythm?
I think my process is really similar. I'm a discovery writer. So what I tend to do is I write really short first drafts, but they might take me a long time to write because an idea has to percolate for quite a long time. And then I will redraft and redraft until I feel like it's solid enough to send to my agent. And well, I think my writing is actually getting a lot better, but I do think it's taking me longer to get the story, the first draft. I think it's because I think you become a bit more market savvy once you're in the industry and you want to write something quite hooky and you want to write something that you feel like you haven't seen before. And I think that gets harder as you write.
Of course. And I think also I imagine the pressure on the kind of not better the books you've written before, because obviously they're all fantastic. But in your mind, you think I'm going to up my game each time, right?
Yeah, and I want to challenge myself every time I want to do something I haven't done before. I think I have similar, my books always seem to have a did he, didn't he element to them.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy writing stories like that. And so I feel like I do write the same conflict, but in different scenarios, different locations. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, even though you say it's the same formula, it's all very, very like, you know, different stories, different people, different settings. So it's not like you're a one trick pony by any stretch.
I mean, I feel like they're all very, very different books. I feel like, I don't want to do the same thing over and over, but I really enjoy getting, I don't do many dual POVs, really. There's normally one main protagonist and I'm really comfortable writing like that.
So you've mixed it up, you've challenged yourself a bit with this one then in terms of the format and presentation of those stories.
Yeah, I mean, because you hear from Luke through the master interviews.
Yes.
You hear the backstory through him.
Yeah. So with the writing process, a question that I like to ask all of the authors that I speak to Yeah. What do you like most and least about the writing process?
Okay, so I really don't like the first draft.
Yeah.
But there's nothing more satisfying when I write the end on that first draft. I love it. It's like a drug. It's such an adrenaline rush when you finally worked it out and you finally worked out how to tell this story. But the process I find terrifying. Just going to my laptop every day, forcing myself to write my word count and actually not knowing if it's actually going to go anywhere. It's horrible. So that's my least favourite.
So as a discovery writer, and you're kind of figuring it out as you go and the story's growing with as you go, does that mean you're kind of constantly researching as you're writing?
I'm just constantly thinking about it. And right. So, for example, this book I'm writing at the moment, I got the initial idea for it probably last summer. I managed to get it to a stage where I could write a three-act outline.
Wow.
And then but the problem is with these books, you're sort of writing two books. You're writing the book you want your reader to think they're reading. And then you're also writing the book that they're actually reading.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time I get the first layer quite early on, like, okay, this is a book, this is where it's set, these are the characters, this is sort of what's going to happen. But then to work out the twist and actually what's going on can take a lot longer, especially these days, because I think people reading the genre are so savvy and they've read so much of the genre that you have to really dig deep to give them the thrills that they want. And they want to read something they've not read before. Otherwise, I think they feel unsatisfied. So it's quite tough.
And you also go in, I think, with the savvy readers who are looking for twists. They're anticipating twists. So it's like, how do you write knowing that your reader is going to be laser focused to kind of find these twists as they come up?
So I've basically set myself up for a massive fall, Frankie, by having these big twists. Yep. And now I'm like, okay, I always have to have these. No, it's really fun working out what the twist is.
Yeah.
And then once you work out the twist, you can generally make it really hard for your reader to find it.
Yeah.
Because that's when you can start the red herrings and, okay, so I'm going to take Mr. down this road now and then down that road, and you can have a lot of fun with it.
So in terms of, I imagine it's different for every twist, but like you come up with a twist and then you think, then you work backwards to think, how do I hide it and how do I get to it at the same time?
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. There's a lot of skill in that.
You've got to hold a lot in your head and it has to percolate for a long time. And I mean, I'm a discovery writer, but I do get a spreadsheet out probably after I've done a couple of drafts and then just work out where everything is. Yeah. But you just have to, I find it quite hard doing, once I'm in the edit, which I am now, I find it really hard doing like a couple of hours here and a couple of hours there. You need like to get your head really into the story because you're constantly having to think about what the character's motives are, what's just happened, what's about to happen, what you want your reader to think is going on, what's actually going on. So you sort of need focus to do that.
Yeah, there's so many layers to it. How do you juggle all of that in your brain and still keep writing ahead?
I actually don't know. You know what? Writing is the only thing I find incredibly, incredibly hard. And I still want to do it.
Yeah.
And it's just this compulsion that I have. And I really get into sort of this, what's it called when you're really focused? I can't remember. There's a phrase for it. And and I just love it. And you just sort of, everything else melts away and you're just in your book. It's great.
Well, you're clearly in the right industry. You're in the right role, if that's the way you feel about it. Was writing always a goal for you, even when you were younger? Or is it something you've come to later?
I had always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to write a book. I used to go on these like school holiday courses at the local bookshop where you used to write your own book and like draw the pictures and they'd bind them for you and everything. And then at the end of the week, your parents would all come for a book launch.
That's amazing. I've never heard of that before. That's so lovely.
It was amazing. And I really enjoyed it, obviously. But so I had it in the back of my head and I loved reading. I loved escaping into a book. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but you know, I was quite an anxious teenager, and disappearing into a Marianne Keyes or a Lisa Jewell book really kind of gave me that solace that I craved. And just the idea that I could do that for other people. Yeah, I just always wanted to do that.
That's amazing. And when you first got published, were you offering to illustrate the books? Because you have practice doing that now.
Luckily, I did. They didn't ask me, but.
You should volunteer maybe, it next time.
I'll email my editor tomorrow and suggest it for the book new
four.
Book. There we
Love
go.
Love it. Speaking of book four, you've kind of mentioned it a bit. I'm so curious. Is there anything you can tell us about it? Or is it all top secret?
It's pretty top secret, but I can say it's part set in New York and it's part set in the south of France.
Oh.
But it hasn't been announced yet, so I can't really say much more than that. But I feel I'm really excited about it.
Wow.
I'm sort of in this stage with it where I am working out how to get the twist to work. So, yeah, it's lots of fun.
Exciting. Great locations to pick from as well. Gorgeous. Excited for those. Okay, a newer question I've started asking people is, what's a line you've written lately or from across your catalogue of books that you are especially proud of?
I thought about this and I actually wanted to talk about a line I wrote for my best friend's secret, which was, it's about Kate. Oh my God, I nearly forgot her name.
You've got a lot of books on the go, it's okay.
So she's a recovering alcoholic, and there's a line that I wrote about her, how she felt about it before she got sober, which is that she was stuck between a life unlived and a life not worth living.
Oh,
and
wow.
That line means a lot to me because I felt like that before I got sober, and I'm really proud of that book. I mean, it was my first pancake, so I do cringe a bit at it, but it means a lot to me, this book.
Yeah, no, that's an incredible line, and so I imagine incredibly relatable for so many people. So to put that into words, that feeling is incredibly powerful. So
yeah,
very,
I really
proud
love,
of yourself.
I really love Kate. I think, yeah, there's definitely a bit of me in that. It's my parents' favourite book that I've written.
Aww.
I think because What She Left Behind was quite scary, and it's the guy in it is so horrendous. My mother was shocked. And but I think, yeah, I'm really pleased I wrote about that because I've had so many messages from women about their journeys getting sober, or women who haven't got sober yet and they've read it and it made them realize a lot about their own lives. So yeah, it's always going to have a bit of a special place in my heart, that one.
So that must make it, I mean, obviously it was a personal thing for you to write given your experiences, but meaning seeing that it's so helpful to so many other people, it must be incredibly rewarding in a way you probably weren't anticipating.
I mean, I've always, the way I digest big themes and emotions is through narrative, through a beginning, middle and end, and and sort of coming out of all that, and it was all like a bit of a hazy mess in my head, and being able to sort of write a beginning, middle and end was really
structure it
exactly, was incredibly therapeutic for me actually.
Wow. Yeah, I can see why it means so much to you. That's an incredible, what an incredible thing to have as well. That's where you've come, also where you started and where you are now. Your journey through telling stories is incredibly impressive.
Well, that book originally was called Closure because I felt like it really did, was like closure for that phase of my life, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And now you're off to New York and Paris,
yeah.
And seeing the world, going to Thailand.
Still wearing my tracksuit bottoms.
Oh, you've got to be comfortable.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the most important part. When you're going on a journey, you've got to be comfortable.
Yeah,
so.
True.
Yeah,
true.
Completely. And you are an incredibly busy woman and you've got a family and you're writing all the time. Do you have much time for reading?
Yes, because I'm an insomniac. So I read. I read for about 2 hours before I go to sleep. The only thing that gets me to sleep is reading.
Wow.
So I read quite a lot.
That's very handy. Not handy, because obviously that's a horrible thing for you to have to be dealing with, but perk of it. then.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm actually, it's the only thing that gets me to sleep. So it's great. I read loads of books. It's definitely a positive.
You're incredibly productive and like alive, considering you're an insomniac. You always seem very, you know, present and alert and awake. I'd be an absolute mess.
Well, I'm very lucky. I've got an absolutely superstar of a husband.
Aw.
He gets up with the kids in the morning. So very lucky.
That's good. So you kind of tag team the sleeping.
Yeah, I do all the night. I do the night shifts. I do pickups and bedtimes and baths. And he does the morning.
That's just a good rota system.
Totally.
Yeah,
we feel quite works smug. We've worked it out.
you've hacked the system.
Hacked the
These
system,
parents
though.
Doing everything at the same time. That just seems inefficient. Idiots. Yeah. People listening, you've got kids. Come on, figure it out. So you obviously read a lot then, which is amazing. But what was the last book that you read and loved?
So actually, can I say two books?
Because of course.
Sort of a common theme. But totally accidentally, I read them back to back. I just read Bright Young Woman by Jessica Knoll. Mm. And then I read The List of Suspicious Things.
I've got that on my shelf to read.
I just finished it
last
night.
Jenny Godfrey, right?
Yeah, Jenny Godfrey. So they're both about known serial killers. So Bright Young Woman is about Ted Bundy, but you never hear his name is not mentioned in the book at all. He's always called the defendant because the book is from the women, their perspective. And it was just one of the characters, I think Pamela, Ruth, I can't remember all their names. I've got a really bad memory. I just was so with them there. And I just fell in love with all the characters. It's such a brilliant, beautiful book and really looks at some hard hitting themes, but doesn't feel salacious or anything like that. It was brilliant. And then The List of Suspicious Things is all about the Yorkshire Ripper, but it's through the eyes of a young girl living in the same town called Miv, and she's 11. And it's sort of, it's a coming of age story. It's very tender, and the characterization is just amazing. These sort of late 70s people living in a Yorkshire town. It's like a hot cup, a hot bath on a Sunday evening. It is, it's just a beautiful book, and I can't believe it's a debut.
I know, she's incredible, and I'm so excited for all of the success she's had already with her debut. And she's so lovely. Did you meet her at Harrogate last year?
No, I didn't. Hopefully she'll be there.
She's super, super lovely. But isn't it amazing as well how the presentation of serial killer stories has evolved in the last few years of when it used to be, like you say, salacious and from the male perspective and kind of sexualized in that kind of way. And now we're seeing it from through women's eyes, both as regaining their power as victims to young children. Like what a journey literature's gone on.
I know, it's amazing. And I'm so pleased.
Yeah.
And those books in particular, they've done it so well. They're really smart. And yeah, I just think they're so talented, both of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So you a true crime fan as well, it's fair to say. I've seen a few references here.
Yeah, I am actually. And I think it's really interesting how I was actually talking to Catherine Faulkner about this morning, about how we sort of lean into our biggest fears, don't we? Especially women. She writes mum noir, you know, that's what they call that subgenre now. And she wrote them when she was a young mother or becoming a mother. And it's like, why do we want to read and write about stuff that we're quite anxious about? And I mean, I think because what she left behind is my mum noir, I think. And I mean, I know during the pandemic, I was stuck in the house with a 6-month-old and a 2-year-old. Oof. And almost to purge myself of the experience, I had to write a book using those same emotions, I think.
Yeah, cathartic.
It was really cathartic. And I think that's probably why we like watching and reading. Yeah.
Yeah.
That genre.
I think as well, personally, I think true crime fascinates me, or I'm so into it, is because I'm always trying to think what's the worst thing that could possibly happen to me. And if I know what it is, then I can anticipate it happening and I can get out of it or survive it. You know, it's like a protective thing where you're planning for the worst possible scenario at all times.
Yeah, I think that. And I think it also gets us out of our own heads a bit.
Yeah.
And I think, right, it sort of prepares you for the emotions you might feel if you were ever in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And also physically, like, how would I fight out of this situation? What tools would I need to, you know, get out of it?
Mm.
Well, I'm constantly covered in weapons, so I'm ready.
Are you?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, Emily, I've had such a bloody lovely time chatting to you, and you're such a lovely person. I always enjoy seeing you at events and things, which is why it makes it so awkward that I now have to confront you with a terrible thing that you have done. Dun, dun, dun. I know.
I'm nervous.
As you should be, Emily Freud, because you know what I'm talking about, right? This terrible, heinous crime that you have committed that was so awful, so shocking in nature. You've now been sentenced to death for it.
Damn it. What was it? What did I do?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? What did you do? Do you want to confess? Is now the time?
You're at, like, my heart's going like this. I feel like I've... You know when you just constantly feel like you've done something wrong? And then someone comes up to you and says, you've done something wrong. What was it?
I didn't mean to trigger anything real. I'm so sorry. It's not just a stupid device to get to a death row meal. It's just a silly game. Please don't have a panic attack. I'm sorry.
I'm going to need to take a beta blocker, Frankie.
God, if you weren't an insomniac before, you are now. I'm so sorry. Okay, well, you've done something bad, but you haven't really done anything bad.
Yeah.
Okay, I promise.
Can I just also say I haven't actually done anything bad? It's not like I'm paranoid that you...
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what someone would say if they'd done something really bad. It sounds a bit like you're on the defensive.
Yeah.
Okay, no, look.
Just don't dig out my back garden, okay? That's all I'm asking.
Okay, well, that seems like a very reasonable request. Not at all suspicious. I didn't know your surname was West. That's an interesting choice. Okay, so you've done something awful. Nothing to do with the back garden, as we've established.
No.
Absolutely not. Well, somebody found out about it because you've now been sentenced to death. I'm really sorry about that. What a bummer. Yikes. And the most upsetting part is arguably that you got caught because, you know, crime writer.
Yeah.
I know your cred's gone right downhill. But the good news is I can get you the death row meal of your dreams. Yay. It's all worth it. So what would your death row meal be?
So it would be, my mum always makes this sweet and what was it? It's a sweet and sour prawn thing. Ooh, which is delicious. And whenever I'm having a bad day, and I reckon being on death row, I'd be having a pretty bad day.
Quite bad, yeah.
She will make that for me.
So I'll bring her into the prison.
She'll come in with her Tupperware. Yeah. Maybe a bit of, you know, nice crusty bread to have all the extra, you know, she'll have everything with her.
Aww.
And is it a course meal or is it just one?
As many as you want. Do you know what? I'll hook you up.
Okay.
I feel bad. Having bullied you with this.
I'd probably just have a simple steak for the main, maybe with some potato dauphinoise.
Nice.
I'd get a bit of carbs for the journey.
Yeah, energy. Yeah.
And then for dessert, I'm going to go back to the mum, another mum classic, her chocolate roulade.
Oh.
She makes every Christmas. My mum's a good cook.
Sounds like it. Wow.
Yeah. But unfortunately, she didn't teach me to cook, so.
Oh, really?
I can't cook. Actually, I can do the prawn thing. It's the only thing I know how to do, so.
That sounds like a good thing to know.
When you come to my house, Frankie, I'll make it for you.
I would love that. Thank you. I don't even have to have killed anybody to get it. This is an extra treat.
Just don't go in the back garden, all right?
Okay, I'm not going in the back garden. Jesus, all right. There's like flies buzzing around out there, whatever. No judgment. Well, that is a great menu. And also, as a fellow non-drinker myself, what would you have a soft drink option? What would your beverage of choice be?
I went to this new restaurant recently and called Mountain, and they did the best non-alcoholic Bacchantes.
Ooh.
I think it was the best non-alcoholic cocktail I've ever had in my life.
Wow.
Non-alcoholic drink, maybe. It was heaven. So I'd have a couple of those.
Wow, I've never even heard of a non-alcoholic Bacchante before. That sounds incredible.
It was excellent.
Wow. Yeah. Isn't it amazing how non-alcoholic drinks, which sounds like such a stupid thing to say because they were around probably before alcohol, but isn't it amazing how well, how far they've come and how nice they are and how readily available they are these days. What a treat.
Honestly, I mean, when I got sober at 28, I mean, there might have been a Beck Zero hanging around.
Yeah. If you're lucky.
I was lucky. But now you go to a pub and they often have non-alcoholic beers on tap. Which is just like mind blowing. So we're so lucky. I think it's a lot easier to get sober now than it was, you know, 5-10 years ago.
Oh my God.
It's a completely different arena.
I remember once I went to an event and there was a champagne bar and I went to the bar and I was like, do you have any non-alcoholic drinks? And the waitress went, I've got a bottle of water in my bag. I was like, do you know what? I'm all right. Thanks, though. Like half drunk bottle of water from her bag.
Oh, my like, God, that's hilarious.
I know. So we've come a long way. Yeah. Thank God for that. Okay. Yeah. Right. Well, so you've had your lovely non-alcoholic Bacardi, 3-course meal, perfection. But unfortunately, you are now dead. I'm really sorry.
Okay.
I know. Really sad. But more good news. Is that I will bury you with the book of your choice. So there you go. You're welcome.
Thanks, Frankie.
You're so welcome. What book would you be buried with? I feel like I've caused you endless anxiety tonight. I'm really sorry.
So my first question is, is there a loophole to be had here? Could I take my Kindle? Because it's literally my pride and joy. As you know, I read into the night and my husband turns the light off. And if I didn't have my Kindle,
you can read.
Would be completely lost. So,
and it'll be dark in the coffin.
It'll be dark in there, Frankie. You can't leave me down there without it.
Okay, do you know what? I will let you have the Kindle, but you need to specify the first book you would read on your Kindle, coffin Kindle.
So I would probably, it's going to be quite scary down there. I really want a thriller though.
Yeah. Well, when in Rome.
Yeah. Okay. So I'd probably, I know it's quite boring, but I would probably have Gone Girl because that is one of the best thrillers, psych thrillers ever. You know, it created, you know, a whole uptick in that genre, that one book. And I love the main character.
Me too.
I can't remember his name right now because I've gone blank. But I just think it's the perfect Nick.
Nick and Amy. That's it.
Yeah, Nick and Amy. I could sit in Nick's head all day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Not just because he looks like Ben Affleck in my head now. But
well, that helps.
That helps.
Yeah. That's a great choice. I think that's boring at all because, as you say, that book is incredible and there's a reason why it's still cited as one of the great thrillers of recent times, and the film is really good as well.
Really good, and I love Rosamund Pike. Have you watched Saltburn?
Yes, she's amazing in Saltburn.
Totally steals it. Properly laughing out loud in the cinema to her. She's amazing.
Yes, she totally steals that film. All the people like have issues with it as a film, and they talk about him being naked and all that kind of stuff. But she to me, the best part. So
I agree. Yeah. That scene with Harry Mulligan, and they're talking about rehab in Liverpool. That's just amazing. I love it.
Oh my God, it's so good. I also just love it when she's like, "Oh no, she died." And you're like, "What?" She's like, "Oh, she's always such an attention seeker." Like,
yeah, just moves off really quickly. Oh, she died.
No, she died. You're like, "Oh, oh, amazing." Well, that is a great choice, and I will let you have your Kindle. I don't know how many books you've got on it. Probably a few thousand, but you're going to last a while. I hope your battery life's good.
Oh, can I have a PowerPoint? Is that
fine? Yeah, I'm going to be the most technologically advanced coffin of all time. So
it's basically going to look like my bedside table, isn't it?
It basically is. Yeah,
glowing jaw. Yeah,
yeah. I can't promise the glass of water is going to be in a good shape down there, but we'll give it a go.
Okay. I probably don't need it.
Probably not. I always find that question so interesting because people take it in different ways. Like when you said loophole, I thought you were going to say, could I use this to get out of it? Because Fiona Cummins took a book on how to become a vampire with her so that she could learn how to overcome death.
It's very clever. I would never have thought of that. Yeah.
No, I mean, this is why you're such different writers, you know, it's such a broad genre. You can cover all sorts. Yeah. But or some people just say, you know, taking books so when they're dug up, it looks impressive when they're found holding something very, you know, pretentious and arty. Or is it, you know, a book to read in the afterlife? But you've gone the afterlife route, yeah. And I respect that. I think that's a good solid plan for the route ahead. But Emily, I've had such a lovely time chatting to you. Thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been such a laugh. I've loved it.
Oh, good. And the book is out on the 11th of April, isn't it?
Yes, it's out on the 11th of April. Here it is.
Her Last Summer. I will screen grab that. Absolutely. And where can people follow you to see more of what you're up to and the next book? More excitement about that.
So I'm on Instagram. What's it called? My
handle. Username, whatever you want.
My handle is Emily Freud_. I'm on Twitter at Ms. Emily Freud as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. I'll be back soon with another author interview. But until then, Emily, another thing is I never know how to end an episode of this stupid podcast. How should we end this?
How about you press stop and then afterwards I'll tell you about the guy in the back garden.
Okay, yeah, I mean, there's nothing in the garden. Okay.
Nothing in the garden.
All right, bye.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while revelling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule, wherever you get your podcasts.